of the Delta variant did obviously affect the Fed's plan to reduce this QE. Nevertheless, the Federal Reserve on September 22nd cleared the way to reduce its monthly bond purchases soon, as it said, and then signaled interest rate increases may follow more quickly than expected. This would involve 9 of 18 U.S. central bank policymakers who have projected borrowing costs will need to rise in 2022.
At the Federal Reserve, we are strongly committed to achieving the monetary policy goals that Congress has given us, maximum employment and price stability. Today, the Federal Open Market Committee kept interest rates near zero and maintained our current pace of asset purchases. These measures, along with our strong guidance on interest rates and on our balance sheet, will ensure that monetary policy will continue to support the economy until the recovery is complete.
Let's try to get an idea about this QE. We have Justin Urquhart-Stewart joining us. He's director of the Seven Investment Management and founder head corporate development at the investment fund 7IM. Justin, welcome. How does the QE work? We know that it involves the printing of money. We also know that the New York Fed and the ECB have printed lots of money, even the ECB said to have negative interest rates. Tell us how this whole process gets executed.
It's fascinating when you look at quantitative easing, because you find any economics book of, say, 30 years ago, and there will be no mention of it at all. So this is a relatively new phenomena in terms of its description and its application by central banks. All it is, in fact, is you're getting the government to be issuing debt, and then its central bank is then buying its debt. And therefore, what you're doing is it creating that value, which you could then call printing money. But effectively, what they're doing is putting more money into the system. Now, that can work quite well. And of course, the clever thing is, if you think that the bank, central bank and the state are one and the same, then they've got the items on both sides of the balance sheet. You have the assets and the debt. So in theory, because they're one and the same, in due course, they can match them off and wipe them out. But they can't do that yet, because it would lose that vital word that runs any economy, which is confidence. And they have to have confidence in those central banks so they know what they're doing. And I have to say, at the moment, there's a real concern when you look at the central banks, because they're now trying to ease the market forward to say to them, interest rates are going to go up, but they are not going to go up now, so there's no need to panic. And this is what we had a few years back when you had something known as the taper tantrum. They were going to taper down the level of quantitative easing, the levels of borrowing, and be able to try and make sure there is still support in the economy, and therefore interest rates will start going up from where they are at the moment, as you correctly said, when they were negative. So the market's going to watch this very carefully indeed, and it's going to be an incredibly sensitive issue. Now, overlay on that the aftershocks of COVID, we haven't resolved that all of that issue, but overlay on that the geopolitical issues, particularly between America and China, and we have some very big risks to manage during this, so it's going to be a sensitive time with a very, very sensitive financial subject.
The money that the world is awash in is truly worrying. One thing not even covered in this program is the world of dark money. Anyways, all in all, the world is drowning in cash and in turn debt. The question that then arises is, how can this amount of debt ever be repaid? Well, of course it can't. The World Economic Forum blatantly admitted so. It said that at the end of 2015, Greece's public debt was 176% of its GDP, while Japan's debt ratio was 248%. The U.S. stands at 125%. None of these governments will ever repay all that they owe. Write-offs and monetization are inevitable. Total world public debt, 215% and rising. And that was back in the year 2016. Rejoining us for this final Q&A of the program is Jack Rasmus, professor of economics, and also we have Justin Urquhart-Stewart, director of the Seven Investment Management. Jack, my final question to you. According to strategists at Bank of America, trillions of dollars, euros, and yen have been created to shore up global financial systems, provide the much-needed liquidity. But given QE and stimulus back from the 2008 financial crisis, isn't the world awash with so much debt that it's nearly impossible for it to repay back?
Well, it's not only awash with debt, but it's awash with an incredible amount of liquidity, money capital all over the place. That's why these stock markets are not really correcting. There's so much trillions of dollars sitting on the sidelines in investors' hands that whenever the market starts going down a little, they commit more of this liquidity money if they pump it back up, they just keep buying the dips, and there's no corrections going on anymore because there's so much money that the feds and central banks have thrown into the global economy. How long can this go? Well, the whole question is how long will the central banks keep throwing this money, especially Western central banks, into their economies and creating these financial asset bubbles?
Well, Justin, that sounds like a good question that I could throw at you. For how long can this then go on, which, as our guest Jack Rasmus indicated, has created this financial bubbles with all this money being pumped into the system, giving QE and stimulus from the 2008 financial crisis? Isn't the world now awash with so much debt? Again, my question, that there's no way they can possibly repay it back?
The answer to the question is actually in the question itself. The world is awash with all this debt. And the question is, therefore, can it be sustained? Well, it can be sustained as long as you have that vital word of confidence again, or you'll have that other phrase, which is the emperor's new clothes. That's to say, does everyone stop losing confidence in actually what's happening? And then they start selling, and that's when you'll see a real danger to the global economy. So the central bankers have to manage this very carefully indeed. We have eye-watering amounts of debt, which, after all, neither you nor I can actually get enough numbers, enough noughts on our calculators to actually see it. So what they need to do is manage it over the longer term. They've got inflation beginning to rise, which is quite helpful because it starts to erode the value of the debt. But inflation has a nasty habit of getting out of hand, so they've got to be careful. If they raise interest rates too quickly, they'll frighten the market. And if you raise interest rates at all, the cost of that debt does go up. And that's going to be a large cost, which, frankly, none of these nations are really prepared to be able to manage effectively.
Global debt is spiraling out of control and is fast approaching record $300 trillion. It seems like many countries are after
debt. This is Tehran, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We're covering live the 35th Islamic Unity Conference, which is being held in Tehran. Earlier you heard Ziad al-Nakhala, the head of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, make a speech, the opening speech of the conference. Now it's turn of Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to deliver his speech to the conference. Let's listen in.
Esteemed participants and guests and the Muslim Ummah, I also wish to thank the organizers of this enlightening and effective conference, particularly the Secretary General of the World Assembly for the Proximity of Islamic Schools of Thought, Mr. Shahriari, who is also Deputy for International Affairs of the Office of the Leader, and also the Head of the Council, Mr. Ghazi Askar. I also salute the pure soul of Ayatollah Tasqiri, who has truly founded a very good foundation, and he played a crucial role in the field of scientific exchanges in the world of Islam. He made valuable efforts, and God's mercy be upon his soul. I also commemorate the great martyr, Haj Qasem Soleimani, who carried out practical actions in order to promote unity within the Muslim Ummah. His practical steps and also the scientific steps by Ayatollah Tasqiri were quite influential, aimed at eliminating doubts and deviations in the world of Islam and also creating unity amongst the Muslim Ummah. I salute their souls, and I salute the pure souls of the martyrs, Masrat Sheikh al-Islam and Sheikh Tuti, and also the Muslim thinkers and ulemas who are not present, but their actions were aimed at proximity, and their actions were quite valuable And we do attach importance to such efforts that were made in this regard. The thought of proximity and the Muslim unity that was emphasized by the late Imam, and also today the leader Imam Khamenei is also emphasizing this very point. This is a strategic and necessary move in the world of Islam, and all the Muslim thinkers and ulama must underscore this issue. The Prophet of Islam plays a pivotal role with respect to unity. A glance at his tradition and also the pure traditions of the infallible Imams. So paying attention to such traditions is the secret behind unity in the world of Islam. And the infallible Imams, are the secret behind such unity. One should pay close attention to their tradition and their enlightening remarks that will guide Muslim, the Islamic society towards unity. What is obvious is that the unity of the Muslim Ummah is of great importance. In fact, Muslims must be must remain united. There may be a view towards within the Muslim Ummah that requires recommendations. That means to refrain from discord, and these are the recommendations prevailing amongst the Muslim Ummah, so that they should refrain from any statement that may cause discord. There may be also an approach towards the common goal pursued by the Muslim Ummah. And that's what we understand from the term Ummah. Ummah is derived from the term Ammah, that means a collection of religious values that pursue a common goal. So having such a common goal is one of the major elements of the Ummah. Also to be dynamic. The Ummah is not allowed to halt, to stop at any particular point. There should be a divine approach. In other words, all aspects of life, that includes economic, social, cultural, and family dimensions, the pivotal role by the foundation of the family foundation, and also the individual life, one's individual life, they should all be a manifestation of divine values that brings about dynamism, and there should be a common goal set, and also we should resort to our Prophet, the Messenger of God. Also, those who have taught the need for unity and coalition. So these are the four elements within the Muslim Ummah. So if one pursues such an approach, namely to have a common goal, and that is the liberation of the Muslim Ummah from the hegemonic domination, the hegemonic system. So the hegemonic system is after preventing the formation of the Muslim Ummah, to prevent its movement, to prevent the Muslim Ummah's dynamism. So it wants to prevent divine values The hegemonic system wants to strengthen its domination, to dominate the Muslim societies. You see, after World War II and the bipolarization of the world and the disintegration of the former Soviet Union, there was only a single power in the face of the hegemonic system, and that was the great power of Islam. The hegemonic system made efforts in different ways in order to undermine Islam. It posed many threats. The formation of Takfiri groups amongst Muslims, giving weapons to them, providing them with money in order to engage in acts of massacre and violence amongst Muslims. Also, inculcating doubts, and also the enemy's media empires, sowing discord amongst Muslims, and making use of shaky governments, those who were only after their own interests and just think about themselves and the hegemonic system and pay no attention to the Muslim Ummah. That means puppet regimes that were after normalizing ties with criminal regimes such as the Zionist regime. And also, they insulted the sanctities and separating Muslim countries and sowing discord amongst the Muslim Ummah and benefiting from Muslim scientists. The past colonialism was after oil and gas, and today the colonialists are after benefiting from Muslim manpower and human resources. These are all components of the same chain, and they want to put to question the issue of Palestine. These are components of the same chain, and they are, and the hegemonic system is after undermining the parameters of power. Efforts were made in order to make use of money, science, and media power, and through conspiracy and seditions. The hegemonic system has been trying to undermine the Muslims' parameters of power. There are opportunities and also serious necessities for the Muslim Ummah. The opportunities we have includes the huge Muslim population and those believing in divine values and religion, close to 2 billion people, particularly the young population within the Muslim Ummah, and young people have greater tendency towards spirituality and religion, and there is greater tendency towards Islam and teachings of the Prophet and Imam Sadiq, peace upon them. There is greater tendency today in the world of Islam. This is a valuable opportunity. Secondly, you see the situation in the West. There are claims made by the West. You see, in the past years and even the past centuries, all the Westerners have come across failure. That includes the Western culture and also the Western systems, particularly what they have claimed so far. You see that such claims are of no value for our youths because the Westerners have failed. These are all opportunities. If yesterday a young person wished to live in a Western society. Today, he has the feeling that he must stand on his own feet. With the blessings of the blood of martyrs and also guidelines by prominent figures, you see growing Islamic awakening in the region. That's been due to the blessings of the blood of martyrs. What has been said with regard to Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. Truly, the blood of martyrs has eliminated ignorance amongst the Muslim Ummah. There may be some puppet regimes playing a role, but the Muslim Ummah has been awakened. And this awakening is of importance. This blessed conference plays a crucial role for attaching importance to Islamic awakening and make the necessary planning. That's my recommendation to this conference. The awakening that has been created due to the blessings by the blood of martyrs and scholars, such an awakening must not be undermined. There are necessities today with respect to this conference. Speaking of deviations, the conspiracies, there should be a clear understanding of such conspiracies and deviations. I can remember when the Daesh was created with the flag of La ilaha illallah. Some had not properly understood Daesh. At that time, I can remember that our wise leader announced that the nature of activities by Daesh is the same of the Zionists. What is a Muslim cannot shed blood like this, having no mercy towards young and the old. This has been directed by the Zionists. This has been directed by the Zionists, and the U.S. State Secretary officially announced in a presidential campaign that the U.S. has created Daesh. To understand such a conspiracy and deviation is of importance. We see a conspiracy today in Lebanon, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria. So it's important to have the right perception of such conspiracies. And the ulamas and distinguished scholars and thinkers, I welcome you all. Your enlightening role within the Muslim Ummah is quite influential to monitor such deviations and issue warnings in order to immunize the Muslim Ummah in the face of such conspiracies and plots. Expansion of media and scientific cooperation is of importance. Expanding scientific, media, cultural cooperation within the world of Islam. That's an important necessity. Thirdly is the strengthening of the proximity school of thought. That's one should take steps for strengthening Islamic unions in Muslim countries. One should take steps in order to prevent the marginalization of the Palestinian issue. And one should be focused on the issue of Palestine. And the Islamic Republic of Iran, as a supporter of the oppressed, is prepared to assist and help. And also strengthen convergence And speaking of differences and conflicts, we can act as a haven in order to create peace, security, and eliminate conflicts, and take steps for the social and cultural development of the world of Islam. We do extend our hands for friendship with Muslim countries, and we do emphasize such friendship, and we want to eliminate poverty in the world of Islam, to eliminate corruption, to eliminate terrorism, to eliminate insecurity. And I wish to conclude by saying that we are after establishing tranquility in Muslim states, and the enemy is after creating insecurity. We consider unity as our strategy, and the enemy is after sowing discord. Either wantedly or unwantedly, knowingly or unknowingly, any person who says something or takes any action aimed at eliminating unity, that's been a move in line with the wishes of the enemy. So we should all be obligated to consider this as a divine gift and protect unity and emphasize unity. I wish to once again welcome you, and hopefully such a conference would contribute to the promotion of the Muslim Ummah, and I benefited from the remarks by the participants and speakers. Thank you very much for your attention.
Well, you've been listening to Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi's speech in the inauguration ceremony of the 30th.
You've just listened to Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi delivering a keynote speech at the 35th International Conference on Islamic Unity, which is currently being held in Tehran. President Raisi just delivered his speech. Just some of his main points were, President Raisi mentioned that the imperialists and hegemonic powers don't want to see Islamic unity. They don't want to see science, technology develop within the Muslim world. He said, an important point is that the Muslim masses have been awakened, and this conference, the Islamic Unity Conference, plays a key role in awakening of Muslims. President Raisi said, expansion of scientific, technological, and media cooperation between Islamic countries is of vital importance, and he encouraged cooperation and collaboration in science, technology, and media between various Islamic countries. He also emphasized that he said that the key difference between us and the enemies is that we want to promote stability. The enemies of Islam want to promote chaos and insecurity. And he said he encouraged those scholars who have gathered, Sunni and Shia scholars who have gathered here in Tehran, to do everything they can to promote Islamic unity and cooperation between Islamic countries. Okay, we now go back to our regular programming. We'll be covering this important 35th International Conference on Islamic Unity. We'll be covering it today, but we'll go back to our regular programming for now.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The Saudi government made an intense effort to kill the UN investigation into war crimes so that they and their allies could continue killing innocent Yemenis with impunity. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Daniel Larison, writer. This article is published under the heading Abandoning Yemen to War Criminals. Stay tuned for more. The United Nations body responsible for monitoring and recording human rights abuses effectively abandoned the people of Yemen recently. In a 21-18 vote with 7 abstentions, the UN Human Rights Council, UNHRC, refused to extend the mandate of an independent investigation into war crimes committed by all sides in Yemen. Since its establishment in 2017, the Group of Eminent Experts, GEE, had served as a limited mechanism for holding war criminals in the conflict accountable for their outrages against the civilian population. The Saudi government had fought against the establishment of an investigative group early in the war because they wanted to keep the coalition's crimes concealed from international scrutiny. Now the Saudi government has successfully lobbied enough members of UNHRC to shut down the investigation into the crimes that they and other belligerents have committed against the people of Yemen. The vote showed how indifferent most of the world still is to the plight of the people of Yemen after more than 6 years of carnage and famine. The Saudis have the most to gain by killing an independent investigation. It is the more than 23,000 Saudi-led U.S.-backed coalition airstrikes that have been responsible for most of the civilian deaths in the fighting, and the coalition continues to bomb Yemeni civilian targets without regard for innocent life. The Yemen Data Project has tracked coalition airstrikes since 2015, and it condemned the UNHRC vote as soon as it happened. This is terrible news for all those seeking accountability and transparency in the conflict in Yemen. This decision gives carte blanche to the conflict's belligerents to do what they want with zero accountability, oversight, or consequences, unquote. Aid groups have likewise denounced the Council's capitulation to Saudi pressure. It was the first time since the Council was created 15 years ago that a resolution at the Human Rights Council was rejected. And by all accounts, it was Saudi influence that was responsible for the outcome. The Saudi government stands out as one of the worst culprits in the war, and that is why they are so determined to bury the evidence of their crimes. The independent investigation has documented extensive abuses and crimes by all parties to the conflict. The most recent GE report in September found that there has been no serious effort to rein in the abuses on any side. With Yemen experiencing an unparalleled humanitarian crisis, the group of eminent international and regional experts regrets that the conflicting parties continue to engage in serious violations of international human rights law and international humanitarian law, and that third states continue to provide arms and military support to parties to the conflict, with little regard for the immense suffering caused to the people of Yemen. Regarding the U.S. role in the conflict, the 2021 GEE report noted that the Biden administration had committed to ending support for Saudi coalition offensive operations, but the report adds it remains unclear what this terminology means in practical terms. The investigators can be forgiven for not being able to discern what changes the Biden administration has made to U.S. support for the Saudi coalition. The Biden administration certainly hasn't done much to clarify matters in the 8 months since the president made that initial announcement. The humanitarian crisis in Yemen remains dire. According to reports, more than 20 million Yemenis in a population of around 30 million need humanitarian assistance. The World Food Program says 16 million of them are marching towards starvation due to a combination of conflict and a crippling economic crisis. These conditions have been created by the warring parties, and they have created them by using starvation as a weapon. Half the population of Yemen is being slowly marched towards death. The GEE report states that the dire humanitarian situation in Yemen could be substantially mitigated if parties to the conflict began to respect and comply with their obligations under international law. But clearly, that will not happen unless there is substantial pressure on the belligerents to do so. The GEE released a statement after the vote to end its mandate, imploring the people of Yemen should not be forgotten, the people of Yemen must not be silenced. Unfortunately, the decision to end the monitoring of war crimes is typical of the international response to Yemen's war and humanitarian crisis. The people of Yemen are ignored as much as they are because there is no one that can credibly speak for the majority of Yemenis, and they remain trapped in a war that is waged upon them by states and armed groups that thrive on the mayhem. The Saudi government made an intense effort to kill the UN investigation into war crimes so that they and their allies could continue killing innocent Yemenis with impunity. The very least that the U.S. can do under circumstances is to stop enabling their ability to wage war on the people of Yemen. The lack of international support for credible independent investigations into war crimes in Yemen is a serious blow, but it is not the end of the effort to hold war criminals into account. There are still human rights groups doing the essential work of documenting crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Mutuana for Human Rights is one outstanding example of an organization that seeks to hold all parties to the conflict accountable for their violations of international law. Their work will be more vital than ever now that the Human Rights Council has given up on the country.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I'm really thirsty. Actually, I don't like to drink the cold water of the refrigerator. So, I always drink the tap water directly. Oh, it's great. Well, did you know that Tehran has the best drinkable water? One of the sources of Tehran water is the water of Latian Dam. Today we are going to take a one-day tour to Latian Dam. Latian Dam is on Jajrud River, south of Lavasan City. This dam is located 5 kilometers north of Jajrud, south of Lavasan, and 10 kilometers from Tehran. Latian Dam is built at the confluence of the two rivers of Jajrud and Barg-e-Jahan. Jajrud River is located 30 kilometers northeast of Tehran and flows to the southeast from the northwestern part. Jajrud region, which has great sceneries and villages around, is one of the oldest and most important places to visit in Tehran. Latian Dam supplies 30% of the drinkable water of Tehran. The studies for constructing the dam was conducted in 1959, and after 4 years, the construction of the dam started. This dam became operational in 1967. Latian Dam is one of the biggest dams of Tehran. I am now in Jajrud. I have to find the Jajrud bridge first in order to reach the dam. And after getting there, I have to walk 5 kilometers. Today the weather is good and I'm so excited to see the dam. And now I am exactly where the Latian Dam is located. Oh, God. What an extraordinary scenery. The river of Latian Dam is so beautiful. Besides having tourism facilities, this region has pleasant weather, which would be a good motivation for nature travelers for taking a one-day trip and enjoy the nature. And a few meters away from where I'm standing, some people are fishing. This lake is full of carp fish, barbel fish, and crucian carp. Well, as you might know, I am a fan of animals' rights, and I hate hunting or fishing. So, I leave the fishers alone and look for the sceneries around. Mountain climbing at the foothill of Latian Dam region, as well as cycling in the pleasant weather of this area, is very enjoyable. Around the lake, there are stations which provide visitors with boat riding and surfing equipment. And of course, I have brought my camera in order to take photos from the unique scenery behind the dam, the river, and the animals of the region. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Purreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Kandahar Mosque blast was the deadliest incident since the U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan in August. It was the second week in a row that a Shia mosque came under an attack claimed by Daesh terrorist group.
I think Daesh attacks must be considered as crimes against humanity. They kill hundreds without being held accountable. The perpetrators are Takfiri terrorist groups and the enemies of Afghanistan and Islam. Taliban, as a new ruler, should maintain security, not only for their officials, but also for citizens.
Recent bomb attacks that targeted our innocent people have no place in Islam. They are misusing Islam's name. The government should take decisive measures and bring those responsible to justice.
Observers see the attacks as part of a larger plot to sow seditions between Muslim brothers in Afghanistan. They add that there are hands-off intelligence agencies and countries behind these divisive plots.
Being defeated in Iraq and Syria, the Daesh terrorist group is taking revenge on Afghan Shias. Also, the U.S. is seeking revenge for its defeat in Afghanistan.
Kandahar attacks comes in line of a series of attacks targeting the unity of Afghan Muslims. Moreover, the most important point about these attacks is that the U.S. is trying to create tensions in the region to involve Iran, India, and Russia in an unwanted war.
The Afghanistan Shia Clerics Council condemned the attack and urged the Taliban government to take action against Daesh and fulfill their promises. Shia clerics called for further unity and solidarity among all Muslims.
The recent daily bomb blasts have caused a wave of shock among Afghans, especially in big cities. Many here say they now expect the Taliban to put an end to the terror attacks by Daesh and establish security in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
France's most repressed political group, the Yellow Vests, have just premiered what they are calling Season 2. In some 300 cities and towns, they have planned to demonstrate in mass numbers for the first time in more than 1.5 years due to the coronavirus restrictions. 3 years ago, the Yellow Vests first donned the reflective protective gear required in French cars to protest regressive gas tax hikes amid record petrol prices. This week, energy costs hit all-time highs in multiple areas.
After 3 years, nothing has changed, except for the fact that things have gotten even worse for the average French person. Life has gotten so much more expensive, but Macron doesn't even care. He doesn't see the demands of the Yellow Vests, or even the French people, as worthy of his attention.
The Yellow Vests were not only the biggest, essentially class-based political movement in the Western 21st century, but they were also incredibly popular. 30 other countries started their own Yellow Vest movements. French polls showed them consistently around a 60% approval rating, and that's despite a constant mainstream media campaign against them. They were falsely smeared with charges of xenophobia, but they held marches against anti-Semitism, while their Paris demonstration was led by a banner of a Muslim woman wearing a hijab. President Emmanuel Macron's hardline policy against them provoked international condemnation.
From November 2018 until June 2019, nearly every Saturday in Paris was a scene of massive state repression. The world was shocked by French-style democracy, which uses indiscriminate tear gassings, rubber bullets, and violence against unarmed protesters while still claiming to be a beacon of political and human rights.
We were so numerous in the beginning, but when people began to see how violent and ferocious the government repressed the Yellow Vests, then many got too scared to protest. The government did everything they could to make us disappear, just so they can govern us according to their selfish whims.
The Yellow Vests' list of major demands are basically a call for an entire rethink of French politics, with everything from leaving the European Union, Eurozone, and NATO, to redistribution of France's enormous wealth, to green energy requiring open public debates and referendums. The Yellow Vests say they'll keep marching in the Saturdays to come, which may prove decisive during the presidential election in April. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Hezbollah held a funeral procession for three of the seven people who were killed by the far-right Lebanese Forces political party led by Samir Jaja. As the families of the victims awaited to bid their loved ones farewell, the slogans were those of grief and pious patience. One of the martyrs, Maryam Farhat, a mother of five, was shot in the head while she was in the comfort of her own home. Her sister says her blood will protect Lebanon from any sedition.
God bless her soul. She has made us proud. And may God give us and her children patience. I want to tell those that are sowing sedition in the country not to think about it too hard, because Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah will not allow it. He is the one safeguarding this country.
Hezbollah officials attended the funeral. The highlight of the event was a speech by head of Hezbollah's executive council, Sayyid Hashim Safiyyuddin, who directly accused the Lebanese Forces party of being behind the shootings.
The Lebanese forces' parties' acts are aimed at initiating a new civil war in Lebanon. This is not new for us. In the past, we warned against such plots without naming anyone. All this sectarian incitement and provocation in the media was only to drag people to internal fighting. Today, they have uncovered their true faces. His masters have hurriedly taken this step to drag the country to a civil war.
The master of the killers, he says, is the United States administration.
This is only one episode of the many episodes that are being orchestrated by the United States of America and is funded by some Arab countries. If you go back to the records of the Civil War, they all mention that the U.S. backs and pushes for such acts and Arab states fund it. They are repeating the same episode.
Sayed Safiyuddin said Hezbollah will not allow anyone to take Lebanon to the misery that the previous generations lived during the time of the civil war, while also calling for justice for the martyrs.
Hezbollah has buried the martyrs who fell in yesterday's shootings, and though the people have chanted that the blood of the innocent will not be in vain, the method of retaliation will not be by taking arms against fellow Lebanese. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Education is considered a fundamental right in the 27-nation European Union, but questions are being raised around the effectiveness of school curriculums. The number of young people who find themselves without a job in the bloc is growing.
We look for jobs. It's very hard to find, especially in the pandemic, and a lot of people lost their jobs. So it's even harder now to find a job.
What do you think?
I think it's not only about jobs. We didn't go to university for 2 years. And people graduated from home. It's an event of a lifetime, and they didn't get to do it.
Nearly all my friends don't have jobs, and the ones who have are paid an absolute misery, because it's not only the having or not having a job, it's having a decent pay.
EU Jobs Commissioner Nicola Schmidt attended a meeting of EU employment ministers on Friday. During an online press conference following the meeting, we pointed out that youth unemployment was already out of control in several EU nations prior to the pandemic, namely in Greece, Spain and Italy.
How confident can we be now that solutions can be found after the pandemic when we couldn't really find solutions before the pandemic?
Many sectors are desperately looking for skilled person, for skilled people, and they do not find them. And this shows us that there are major mismatches on our labour market.
So the Commissioner believes reskilling for the digital age is the answer, but the European Commission has been talking about that now for almost a decade. Economists are saying official EU youth unemployment data at present is misleading. COVID-19 financial supports have been keeping jobs alive, but these government programmes are now being withdrawn. A potential tsunami of job losses is being forecast. The vast majority of those in precarious employment are young adults. Associated mental health issues and homelessness are big concerns. An EU social summit is scheduled for next Wednesday. Civil society organisations say the problems are well known. It's time, they say, to finally find solutions. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Angry and grieved, Afghan expatriates in Iran gathered to mourn the loss of dozens of their fellow citizens who were killed in a deadly bomb attack on